part of our shared human history. Our jaw morphology, musculature, and omnivorous teeth are not like those of, say, cats or dogs. We are more utilitarian, part predator, part prey. We ate plants and insects, but we also knew how to fight and kill. In their book, Man the Hunted, anthropology professors Donna Hart and Robert Sussman describe our human ancestors as just one of many, many species that had to be careful, had to depend on other group members, had to communicate danger, and had to come to terms with being merely one cog in the complex cycle of life. Not much has changed in our makeup. Only the pieces are rearranged. In your bones, you remember fight or flight, the possibility of claws holding you down, the rip of jaws and teeth rending flesh. Four choices. One, shout and wave. Pelt the bear with rocks, cookware, or bean cans. Two, jump in our canoe and paddle swiftly away, come back to face the carnage of our campsite later. That is, if we could battle our way upstream to reach the remains of our camp in the big, fast river. Three, scramble to the far end of our island in the jackstraw of washed-up trees, branches sheared off by tumbling, and watch our fate unfold from there. Four, do nothing at all. The last response seemed best, the only thing requiring momentary paralysis. The bear was now fighting harder with the current, glancing over its shoulder at us, nose sticking up, paws paddling like big wet mitts. Every stroke was a grunt, working for extra purchase. We could hear the size of its lungs. When we saw its eyes, it was clear what the bear was thinking. As it looked over its shoulder past us to the downstream end of our island, gauging how much beach was left, it realized it had miscalculated. The bear put more punch into each stroke, trying to catch up, but the current was too fast. Barrel-chested, it took in a huff of air, its vigorous swim reduced to a light paddle. The game was over. The bear sailed past the tail of our island in muddy, swirling water. It didn't gain another shoreline for about half a mile, and it did not look back at us. It climbed onto a bank with its wet, shaggy hide and ambled into a birch grove and the matrix of its endless summer day. For Ice Age people, our black bear encounter might have served as entertainment. Black bears didn't live this far north at the time. They were too small and easy to eat. Their Ice Age bones have been found along coastal southeast Alaska, but not here in the interior. They might have been regarded the way we look at wolverines, dangerous, toothy animals, but small, something you'd hope to fend off with a big stick. A black bear playing cat and mouse with people, with bean cans, knives, and bear spray, that would have been entertaining, something viewers could clap and laugh to. Arctotis would have been more swift and final. It would have entered the current like a tank. The paleo audience would have cringed as the great bear charged. They'd have thought about this so many times it would have been pure muscle memory. Estimates in body mass based on the size of major limb bones commonly show Arctotis weighing around a ton. Some scientists have suggested that the short-faced bear was not a meat eater, though. Isotopic analysis of teeth from the European cave bear indicates that this famed and feared old world ursine was almost strictly herbivorous. The same, they suggest, could be true of Arctotis, whose closest living relative is the spectacled bear of South America, primarily a plant eater. I visited Dr. Sue Ware, a forensic paleontologist specializing in carnivores, who scoffed at the idea that Arctotis had a diet anything like its modern South American relative. She showed me an Arctotis skull that would take up most of a passenger seat of a car, wear open the jaws, revealing a full set of meat-slicing and bone-crushing teeth, somewhere between those of a hyena and a cat. This was no herbivore, she said. She invited me to try it on, and I opened the jaws and stuck my head inside. My own skull fit perfectly. It could have clamped down on the top of my head and whipped me against the ground like a fish. If Todd and I had dived into the river to escape, Arctotis would have been on us almost instantly. The one-ton bear would have batted us back to shore as if swatting salmon out of the water, then held us down one at a time. We would have felt meat being stripped from our bones, or we would have felt nothing, our minds knowing when it was time to go silent. Morphologically speaking, the short-faced bear was probably neither pure herbivore nor pure carnivore. Specimens from Nebraska, California, and Alaska have cranial and dental formations that complicate the hypotheses. It appears that they were neither fast-running superpredators, plant grazers, nor dedicated scavengers, but rather all of the above. Researchers comparing the traits of jaws, teeth, and skulls called Arctotis a colossal omnivorous bear whose diet probably varied according to resource availability. Its actual diet has been revealed through bone chemistry. Isotopic composition of short-faced bear collagen tells us what the animal ate, and Alaskan short-faced bears ate mostly meat with some vegetation. They ingested the meat of not just camel, mammoth, and horse, but large carnivores, canids, and cats. The bear was both scavenger and hunter, subsisting off meat augmented by a salad of steppe grass, wildflowers, and berries. In many ways, it ate like a modern Alaskan interior grizzly, but it was significantly larger, a big, toothy welcome to the new world. I felt the Porcupine River come in from the right, but I didn't see its confluence. The water changed color, became slightly clearer with less mountainous debris. The current swelled and picked up speed, given more mass and momentum, but the merger was invisible among big open bends and islands. Rivers seemed to become each other. I'd heard its name and saw it on a map. I knew that somewhere nearby was another thread coming in from far away. The Porcupine starts in northwest Yukon Territory, Canada, 500 miles upstream of where we were. Its headwaters are a filigree of oxbows and winding channels among muskeg and spruce, a place called Old Crow Basin. On the side of the basin, a limestone outcrop stands over broad taiga, a high point looking across the circle of the far north. This outcrop holds three small rock shelters known as Bluefish Caves, the site of what is possibly the oldest human activity on this side of the world, a likely place to end up if people were following the biggest rivers off the land bridge upstream into the continental interior. 36,000 mammal bones were recently analyzed from in and around two of the caves, and researchers reported that wolves, lions, and to a lesser degree foxes were the main agents of bone accumulation and modification, but humans also contributed to the bone accumulations in both caves. During the late Pleistocene, Old Crow Basin was a megafauna refuge. Big animals waited out the coldest, most brutal climate trends here, leaving permafrost cut banks and cave floors littered with their bones. People would have smelled this at the meeting of the rivers. The Yukon would have been highly variable, flowing out of the folded arms of the ice sheets that capped half of North America. The Porcupine flowed out of lakes and muskeg, its headwaters curled up in the Beringian interior. It would have smelled alive compared to the ice-dominated Yukon. And the first people would have detected bones and grass in its waters, hints of mammoths and short-faced bears, graveyards of tusks, and herds of Pleistocene horses. They could have read this much and more at the river's confluence, where I was only aware that a new river had come in. Old Crow Basin has produced flakes of stone tools, the oldest of them representing the Dyuktai complex, from Dyuktai Cave in the Aldan River Valley of northeast Siberia. Sprawling river systems drain the central Siberian plateau, home of these Dyuktai artifacts. Hopping from one river to the next, people would have reached the land bridge and eventually the Yukon River, which would have lured them farther east, leading them up the larger Porcupine until they finally arrived in Old Crow Basin. The Dyuktai tradition consists of burins, scrapers, perforators, wedge-like cores, and pressure blades struck from the edges of stones. They first appeared in Asia around 35,000 years ago. Jacques Sangma, a Canadian researcher of prehistoric lithic technology and at the time curator for what is now the Canadian Museum of History in Gatineau, Quebec, was the first to identify Dyuktai in North America. Sangma was the original investigator at Bluefish Caves in the 1970s and 80s, where he and his colleagues found stone tools and flakes mixed in with Ice Age fauna. They came up with small, sharp flint knives used to manufacture the tailored clothing and skin and hide shelters necessary for life in the North's cold climate. These microblades were like scalpels, ideal for cutting skins and hides into precise sizes and shapes. Sangma thought this looked like a Siberian technology. He presented his discoveries to audiences that were unresponsive, if not openly hostile. The going story was that the first people in North America were Clovis mammoth hunters who cruised in on the land bridge and filled the continent 13,000 years ago. Sangma had come up with a different story, finding human dates between 27,000 and 24,000 years ago, not part of the popular model. His work was mostly dismissed. At conferences, he was ignored, sometimes derided, his radiocarbon dates declared contaminated and unreliable. Old Crow Basin was not accepted as a location for the first people. Bluefish caves continued to produce stone flakes, hammered rock cores, and the remains of Ice Age megafauna, credible evidence that people were taking shelter here in the late Pleistocene. In 2017, 4 decades after Song Ma began work at the caves, his pin went back in the map, a Pleistocene horse jaw from Bluefish, butchered by stone tools when it was fresh, came up with a radiocarbon date of 24,000 years old. 15 Ice Age bone samples with clear human cutting and butchering marks, originally collected by Song Ma, were re-examined by Lauriana Bourgeon, a doctoral candidate in anthropology at Université de Montréal. Bourgeon subjected 6 specimens to radiocarbon testing and came up with dates between 12,000 and 24,000 years old, the oldest a series of long intentional cuts on the inside of a Pleistocene horse's jawbone. These appear to be filleting marks, consistent with removing the horse's tongue, a likely procedure by hunter scavengers 24,000 years ago. Analysis of one of the teeth in this jaw indicates that the horse died in spring or summer, a warm season's meal. Though this is a clear vindication for Song Ma, it is still not the oldest date in the American North. Signs of people arise 40,000 years ago, a presence as faint as a shadow, a horizon of uniquely shattered mammoth bones in Bluefish Caves and the surrounding basin. The late Richard Moreland, an archaeologist who worked at the caves alongside Song Ma and assembled the Canadian Archaeological Radiocarbon Database, found these bones and concluded they'd been shattered by early people. They must have used rocks, lifted them overhead, and slammed them down on the bones, creating a distinctive break not seen in trampling or general decay. Such breaks are known as spiral fractures, and they form in bone only when it's green, when an animal has recently died. No artifacts were found alongside the shattered bones, so most archaeologists have steered clear of them, and the early date has been given little credence. But the fact remains, someone was probably here. A new agency or process at work on large vertebrates in the Old Crow Basin 40,000 years ago. Who they were, where they came from, and where they went remains a mystery. Similarly, shattered bones have been found in the American interior with dates old enough to say that people, at least hominids, appeared much earlier than is generally credited. The mixed DNA from half-human and half-Neanderthal bloodlines found in a 45,000-year-old human leg bone from Siberia suggests who these bone breakers might have been, an early primitive wave, a lost people of mixed race living as far away from the human core as they could get. They may have found the winding tributaries and lakes of the Upper Porcupine River and traveled here seasonally to smash bones and scoop out marrow. In a 1999 paper on their final analysis of Bluefish Caves, Song Ma and Moreland wrote that Eastern Beringia offered no known ecological obstacle to colonization by people adapted to northern latitudes. Our interpretation of altered mammoth bones indicates that such a level of adaptation had been achieved by at least 40,000 years ago. We presume that people had spread across Beringia by that time. Gyuktai technology is more than a shadow. Microblades and the chips of rock left over from their manufacture mark the appearance of the first identifiable technology in Canada and neighboring Alaska, what might be called the first fine-grained evidence of a people's presence. They were in place by 24,000 years ago, not just breaking bones, but warmly dressed and braving winters in pole and skin huts, their tools and weapons refined as the earliest identifiable humans drifted across Beringia. For me, there was no past. I was a minor god striding through the world, leaning from the bow of our canoe as if into a creation story. I could name things as I saw them, a colonist at heart. That is a bear. That is a cumulus cloud. This is rain. This is sunset. The world was opening to me, unknown and undiscovered as far as I could see. On a sunny day, cumulus clouds rising far from each other, I was half asleep in the canoe, straw hat pulled over my eyes. Todd rested in the stern, paddle stowed, paperback shading his face. I heard him sit up. He said, "Someone's out there." I opened my eyes to a lattice of sunlight. "Out on that island, waving," he said. I put on my hat and pulled out binoculars. Across ripples of sunlight and water, my focus drew on a shirtless man standing on an island where he'd beached a canoe. I studied him for a moment. Black crop of hair, no beard, a small amount of gear, modest camp. He looked skinny. He stopped waving as we took up our paddles and turned in his direction. He didn't appear to be Athabascan or Inupiat, did not look like a local. He had the gear of a long-distance traveler. When we were close enough, he waved excitedly with one hand, calling out, "Hello!" His accent was unmistakably Japanese. We glided up to his island as he stepped into the water in laceless sneakers. He grabbed our bow, helped pull us to shore. I jumped out in river sandals. Todd, who'd put on a ratty t-shirt to be presentable, climbed over gear from the stern. The man was weather-worn, face scabby, sunburned, about the same age as the two of us, mid-twenties, another young male mammoth trotting around the perimeters of the world. He said his name. I tried to repeat it, and he laughed. Todd tried next, and we smiled at our unfamiliar accents. I handed him my journal, and he wrote, "Minuto Suginama," in all caps. He said he'd been lost, and we were the first people he'd seen in many days. Minuto explained, with his hands and broken English, how he'd thought he'd fallen off the earth. One of the sloughs must have carried him out to the river's fringe, where he found himself cut off by a splintered log jam piled up from spring runoff. He climbed on top of it and looked across a blockade of locked and busted trees, filling the slough as far as he could see. He gave us an impression of a part of the river we hadn't seen, a dead end that would take days paddling against the current to escape. He was giving us a map of what he'd seen. We pointed back to where we'd come from, describing a sinuous array of channels, the river's inner mainstem, giving him our map in return. He'd picked up a 5-gallon bucket of sticky salmon eggs back in Fort Yukon and appeared to have been subsisting on these alone. We'd already met another solo Japanese traveler before this, a man journeying by kayak. 43 days later, we encountered a Japanese man who flew into Beaver from Fairbanks, a Buddhist coming to find the grave of another Japanese Buddhist, a famous man who married an Eskimo woman and lived out the rest of his days in the Alaskan interior. Now, there was this man, alone in the flats. I wondered if Tokyo was so densely packed that young adventuring Japanese were flying out like shooting stars, any reason to go. We undid straps from our canoe and opened our stores, sending over half a brick of Velveeta, a processed food product that we kept at the bottom of the boxes. This was a substitute for slabs of fat we'd chop into our rice. We packaged up pilot biscuits and dried salted seaweed for him, a 1/2-gallon bag of jerky. He gave us salmon eggs, turning them with his hand like sticky beads, freshening his gift, which left Todd and me forcing our smiles. A meeting like this in the Ice Age, spotting each other across the horizons of eastern Beringia, might have gone the same way. At the very tip of the original human expansion, people would have been few. As Loriana Borjan's 2017 study of Bluefish Caves noted, the archaeozoological evidence, together with the small size of the lithic assemblages, suggests that human occupation was probably sporadic and brief. They may have come from entirely different geographies, Pacific Rim travelers encountering Beringians, coastal people who came up from the Japanese archipelago meeting inland dwellers speaking a different language. They could have separated so long ago in the wilderness of Beringia that they'd forgotten the other people existed, noting only by tools or mannerisms that they either shared some ancient ancestry or they did not. Conversation would have been carried out through gestures and food. If they were enemies, they would not have known. Minuto tore off hunks of jerky from our supplies and ripped at dried seaweed with his teeth. His words and gestures explained how he'd come to this river once before with a canoe, and he'd been enchanted with horizon after horizon opening out before him. On his first trip to the Yukon, he'd gone back to Tokyo after a few hundred miles on the river. Now he was paddling the full length of the Yukon, another 1,000 miles from our meeting to the Bering Sea. When we paddled away, Minuto stayed at his camp and kept waving. After 1/2 mile, I could barely make him out. His island disappeared, and the sudden isolation hit me like nothing I'd felt before. In our short time together, we'd become a small clan. This wasn't a loneliness I felt for myself or Minuto or Todd, but for the three of us together. We'd found each other in the Beringian interior and had again set ourselves adrift, the clan of people who fall off the edge of the world. Chapter 3. House of Ice, 20,000 years ago. An ice mass once covered half of North America. At its greatest extent during the last glacial maximum between 24,000 and 18,000 years ago, the solid glacier, miles deep in places, stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific to the Arctic Ocean, with no way around it. About the size of Antarctica, its surface area was 5 million square miles, anyone coming across the land bridge would have found the way ahead blocked. The permission I'd received in Savunga to walk the land bridge was not carte blanche. It got me this far, but the path ahead was not so clear. The view would have been of the Laurentide ice sheet breaking over the crest of the Alaska Range. The hulk of Denali, tallest mountain in North America at 20,310 feet, would have risen from a throne of glaciers, orders of magnitude larger than anything the people would have encountered anywhere in Beringia. The Alaska Range stabbing through an endless roof of ice would have lifted their spirits with awe, even as it filled them with trepidation. Katabatic winds coming off the ice, generated by the intense cold, made the surrounding land almost uninhabitable, grasses replaced by tundra, rock, and thin, scrubby willow. The people would have entered a country gradually emptied of life. If they climbed high enough onto the ice sheet, around the massive crevasses, they would have looked across an occasional summit sticking through the ice like a ragged bone, a mountain swallowed to its tip. I once saw what they saw. I walked onto the edge of the Greenland ice sheet, looking ahead to 700,000 square miles of ice and snow. I passed through sculptures of cornices and ice pillars stabbing upward. The last living thing I saw had been a muskox a few miles back. Ahead lay a smooth blankness, with a few last mountains poking through. I wore an anorak and heavy boots, my face stung by chill wind. The sense of oblivion drew me. I could feel it bodily like a magnet. I'd live a day or maybe three without shelter out there. I imagined walking onto the ice, not knowing for sure if anything was on the other side. How could the first people have known that this wasn't the end of all creation? To some, it must have felt as if the world was finished and they had reached the final edge. How could they have known about the mountains and rivers beyond the entire bulk of the Americas waiting for them? Chances of survival on the ice could not have been reasonable when the next ice-free land was 1,800 miles away in eastern Montana and the Dakotas, nothing between here and there. That is, if you managed to stay on a direct line, navigating by stars as if you knew the way. 1,800 miles is how far Robert Falcon Scott's expedition had to travel in the austral summer of 1911 to 1912 to reach the pole and get back by sled and human power. Not one of the final polar party survived, including Scott himself. The planks of their bodies, fingers knotted in the ice, were left in a tattered camp with dreary journals. One person had fallen into a crevasse and disappeared. Another, Captain Titus Oates, mortally weakened from frostbite, limped out of camp into a shearing whiteout, famously telling Scott before he did so, "I am just going outside, and maybe some time." His remains were never recovered. With their then-modern tools and gear, Scott and his crew should have had an advantage over Paleolithic explorers, but apparently it was not enough. At the same time as Scott's ill-fated trip, the expedition of Roald Amundsen, a Norwegian explorer, reached the South Pole and returned without a single fatality. Scott relied heavily on the technology of the early 20th century, while Amundsen followed the more traditional advice of the Far North's Inuit regarding navigation and equipment. Some ways of crossing ice are better than others. When I told Richard Vanderhook, state archaeologist for Alaska, that I was heading to an ice field on the Kenai Peninsula to get a taste for crossing a glacial expanse, he asked whether I was doing it right. This was something that Paleolithic people had to have attempted from time to time, one side of their world dominated by ice. He wanted to know if I'd be carrying a shelter made of three caribou hides stitched together, or if the hides of two female bison split with a stone blade and overlapped onto a willow frame. I told him no. He said, "Caves are fine, they can be pretty damn limited. Rock overhangs are good if you could put a fire up against them." I explained that I was going with a group and we'd be taking tents and sleeping bags. I was looking for ways and routes the first people might have used, but I was trying not to be a blundering fool about it. There would be no caves. We were crossing a segment of a several hundred square mile ice field in south central Alaska. Our fires would be liquid fuel stoves, looking like miniature lunar landers, not the bone fires of central Alaska during the Ice Age. Ridding ourselves of modern effects would offer no deeper insights into the Paleolithic, I reasoned. I'd probably die within a week without them. It would be like putting an Ice Age hunter behind a desk, eyes struck with confusion over the keyboard, the stapler. Vanderhook shrugged and said, "Bison hides are lighter to carry if they're female, in case you change your mind." "Is it safe for idiots?" I asked. None of this is safe for idiots, said David Stevenson, my friend and mentor, a soul brother, who would turn 60 while we were out on the ice. He said this as we looked across an empty expanse of mountains and glaciers, nothing but rock and whiteness before us. A mountaineering author and book review editor for the American Alpine Journal, Stevenson was the de facto leader of our group of five heading for the Harding Ice Field, one of the largest remaining ice masses in North America. He and I had taken a few quick trips and mountain climbs in the Chugach Range outside of his home in Anchorage, finding good company with each other, enough to plan this venture. Stevenson was here to ascend his first Nunatak, an Icelandic word for a mountain summit stabbed through the ice, a castle of rock completely isolated. It was on his bucket list, and the Harding has plenty. Stevenson and I assembled a small ice-crossing tribe carrying rope, sleds, skis, and gear on the first load a few thousand feet into the mountains at the edge of the Harding. A giant glacier poured like latex into the crown of the Kenai Mountains. The neck of a ukulele poked out of the top of my pack, gift of a woman we met at the trailhead on the freshly snowed valley floor. None of us knew how to play the instrument, but we brought it anyway. With a pack weight around 80 pounds each, what's the difference? Going into the unknown, talismans might come in handy. It was late May. 47 inches of snow had fallen across the Kenai the week before, and ahead lay frozen, treeless earth. I kicked in step after step, counting my breaths under my load, thinking like a Sherpa, or trying to. 50 steps and rest. 50 steps and rest. I stopped and leaned my weight over my poles, looking up at the two people climbing above me, their shadows flashing against a golden ball of sun, Stevenson breaking a steep, knee-deep trail for the rest of us. I looked down past the other two, kicking their way up behind me. The ladder of our tracks disappeared below them, slipping over an edge. 2,000 feet below, a forested valley was melting out of the snow. A glacial river threw question marks across a plain of gray and rocky outwash. I could still make out the road we'd come in on, a meager ribbon to a dead end. A farewell. People once traveled at the speed of 2 feet, or possibly a paddled boat, but no faster. Most of our evolution was at this pace, one step and the next. The way we zoom around in cars and planes has changed the way we understand the dimensions of geography. Distances are abstract, unapproachable. What you see when you open the shade on an oval window in an airplane and look down 30,000 feet is walkable land. Mesas and mountains appearing ahead, vanishing behind. In the Ice Age, to know about a place was to have been there, or at least heard tell of it. Word of new places came in the form of birds from far away, and a different grit to the rivers. We'd left in a window, a swing season, too early and you could be pinned down for weeks in late spring whiteouts, too late and snow would start melting off the ice, turning its surface into a web of blue-eyed lakes, waterfalls roaring into widening crevasses. This is when you would have gone in the late Pleistocene, a keyhole to slip through. Some Ice Age summers would have been warm enough that meltwater lakes would be forming and bursting across the face of the ice sheet, but most summers would have been frozen solid, nothing but snow accumulation. If we hit it right, a couple thousand feet above here, we would drop our sleds, snap into skis, load gear behind us, and strike off like mariners across the Harding. Doing this would require an advanced base camp, where we could leave extra gear and supplies for a round trip. Ice Age people would have done the same, setting a cache for a return. They may have been crazy, but they weren't idiots. The first night we camped on the mountain's shoulder. Clouds filled the valley, but up here we had a clear sky in the long blue light of an Alaskan evening. A glacier poured 100 feet below us, its blue-bellied crevasses pillared with snow where it came off the ice field. We clinked cups together, celebrating our first load. The two older guys on the trip, Stevenson and his lifelong climbing buddy, John McInerney, who was 59, had brought Scotch whiskey. They called it the drink of mountaineers. They added clumps of snow instead of ice and raised the toast to a safe and meaningful journey onto the Harding. I toasted back home to my kids and my wife, their pictures carried in the top of my pack. Later on, after I came home from the Harding, I would take the wall map of North America that was in my office and turn it sideways. I wanted to make sense of what seems to be no pattern at all, just what archaeologists have managed to find from Ice Age arrivals on this side of the land bridge. I tacked up this edgewise continent next to my desk so that every time I glanced at it, part of me forgot what I was seeing. My life was becoming a blizzard of papers and books, desk swamped, plaster cast of a saber-toothed cat skull stacked on a pile of folders. With the map sideways, it must have looked as if I were going mad. I wanted to see not North America, but an unnamed, unknown continent. The thumb of Florida and the long peninsula of Baja seemed like natural geography rather than part of an emblem. California became north, the eastern seaboard south, and all the letters and words, names of rivers and states, seemed to fall off like dried leaves. A drowned land bridge stretched off one corner of the continent, almost connecting with distant Siberia, while a second land bridge, still intact, snaked along Mexico where it pinched down to Panama, barely touching the head of South America. This peculiar landmass had rough high country across its upper third, a vast river-laden plain in the middle, and low mountains followed by a gentle coastal plain on the bottom. I posted it with sticky notes and pinpoint arrows, charting the wide-open spaces between known Paleolithic finds, looking for how people would have moved, what lands they might have crossed. I'd hold up my hand to form a blank space, an ice cap that covered half of this imaginary continent. Ice was the biggest topographic environmental feature in the way of the first people, something they had to contend with. Somehow people made it over, through, or around this ice sheet long before it retreated, before an inland passage opened between the massive Laurentide ice sheet sitting on the Canadian Shield with its neighbor, the Cordilleran, grown over the northern Rockies, and the coastal ranges, from the Aleutians to Washington State. The two ice sheets had fused together, forming a single mass. In a hall full of hundreds of colleagues in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I watched archaeologist James Ottavasio slam his hand down on the podium and say, "You can die now," his blunt comment aimed at the dwindling number of scientists who insist on a 13,000-year-old date for human arrival, a holdover theory from the 1930s, back when adventurous bands of mammoth hunters were thought to have marched in from Alaska through an ice-free corridor and then dispersed into the American interior. Good starting place, but human stories are never so simple. Ottavasio had been excavating Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, a gloomy cave in the wooded hills and outcrops of southwest Pennsylvania, immediately south of the former ice sheet. There he and his crews found human deposits between 14,000 and 16,000 years old, and below that were five rough radiocarbon ages from fire hearths and bits of what appear to be carbonized basketry closer to 20,000 years old, the middle of the last glacial maximum. Chesapeake Bay outside Washington, D.C. has produced stone tools in earthen layers between 17,000 and 19,000 years old, a time when this part of the eastern seaboard was popular among large carcass scavengers, short-faced bears finishing off fallen mastodons and mammoths. A human-made tool, along with a mastodon skull and tusk, was picked up by a scallop dredge working Chesapeake Bay. The dredge hung up on the skeleton in 250 feet of water, 40 miles off the Virginia Capes. And when the boat captain pulled it loose, he came up with bones, tusk, and a lance-shaped blade. The artifact was long and thin, made of Virginia rhyolite, a local rock later determined to be stained with the same chemical patina as the tusk, meaning the artifact and the mastodon had the same history, inundated first with a saltwater marsh, then submerged in mud at the bottom of a bay as sea levels rose. When the mastodon remains were subjected to radiocarbon testing, they revealed a maximum date of 23,000 years old, making this darkly colored blade possibly the oldest human artifact known in North America. Similarly old dates continue down the eastern seaboard. The Cactus Hill site, along the Nottoway River on the coastal plain of Sussex County, Virginia, has produced ages between 18,200 and 22,000 years old for quartzite flakes and blades and charcoal from fire pits. These dates came from radiocarbon analysis done in the 1990s, which was then corroborated in a 2006 study using optically stimulated luminescence, measuring the last time quartz sediments in layers of sand saw daylight. Meanwhile, sites from Oregon, Texas, and Florida have produced evidence of strong human presence between 14,000 and 15,000 years ago, a time ice still blocked the American side of the land bridge. Continuing down the globe, humans were not latecomers to South America. Instead, human arrival appears to grow older below the equator. One of the key sites in all of the Americas is Monteverde, on the coast of Chilean Patagonia, 10,000 miles from the land bridge, where a human encampment is firmly accepted at 14,500 years old. Deeper excavations at Monteverde have continued to find human flaked stone down to 17,000 years old atop what appears to be a habitation layer with clay-lined pits from 38,000 years ago. People were a long way from the land bridge at surprisingly early dates. As if entering a vacuum, they spread to the farthest corners. Brazil has been weighing in with luminescence-dated 20,000-year-old finds, chipped tool stone from a rock shelter in the canyon-bound Serra de Capivara at the Toca de Chirapaya site. A radiocarbon date from a mastodon at the Taima site on the north shores of Venezuela, at least 15,240 years old, in association with stemmed projectiles similar to those found at Monteverde, 3,750 miles to the south. The Taima projectiles are also similar to those found on the coast of California and the Pacific Northwest, indicating a coastal migration going around the ice rather than over it. Stemmed projectiles play an important part in the story to come. A stemmed point is a distinctive style associated with people living around the Pacific Rim. The point has a tail, an elongated bottom for securing to a shaft. However it happened, whoever they were, people found a way in during the cold heart of the Ice Age. What would have driven them to attempt it is another question. She said my name. It was almost a whisper. I opened my eyes in the tent. Sarah Gilman's sleeping bag was crammed in with mine and a friend named Q, James Q. Martin. He was asleep. She was awake. It was our second night camped near the edge of the Harding. The tent glowed faintly in dawn light just after midnight. "Do you hear that?" Gilman asked. I listened and heard nothing but the mountain breathing, tent fly wrinkling and stretching in the breeze. Last time I was awake, she'd been poring through a glacier safety manual, preparing herself for conditions ahead. We called her Safety Sally, a name she went by on wilderness treks, known for being mindful in remote and dangerous terrain. The book was closed, and it seemed as if she'd fallen asleep and been woken by something outside. She whispered, "Listen, listen." Across our snowy basin, I heard a faint warble, then another. "Songbirds," she said. "Thrushes, I think. They've been flying up from the valley." As I listened, more came through. They were passing in from somewhere else, checking into summer breeding territories. They were the first of the season, and they'd stay through as snow melted, when marmots and foxes would run through the tarns and tundra. I could hear the flutter of their wings landing here at the tail of a storm, just like we had. I had asked Gilman why people would have ventured across ice in the late Pleistocene, and the answer she gave me was, "People do shit." I had to agree, but there must be more. You wouldn't cross 1,800 miles of ice just to do shit. On the other hand, they may have known there was another side to the ice, giving them a reason to venture out. Birds may have been the ones telling them that the world did not end here, that another world lay beyond the ice. During the last glacial maximum, glaciers prevented most migratory birds from reaching Alaska. They couldn't cross the wind-stripped and deathly expanses to nest in the north the way they had during interglacial periods. Deflected and forced to breed on more crowded grounds south of the ice sheet, these birds experienced what is known as a genetic bottleneck, evidence that their ranges were reduced, pressure increased, numbers strained, diversity compressed. Glacially fragmented genomes have been found in guillemots, auk-like seabirds, and in dunlins, an Arctic sandpiper. They've also been noted in bears and reindeer trapped on either side of the ice sheet. Not everything was held back, however. A robin-sized shorebird known as the redknot, Calidris canutus, which wintered in South America and summered in the Arctic, continued flying to the northernmost parts of its range. Its genes show no sign of discontinuity, which means it was coming across the ice to breed in Beringia. The same is true for an Arctic nesting subspecies of sandhill crane, Grus canadensis tabida. Every spring, this large and noisy bird would have appeared from over the ice cap. People living on the Alaskan side would have known that across the ice, somewhere far from view, it was coming from habitable country. The cacophony of sandhill cranes arriving every spring and then raising a ruckus upon departure every autumn was proof that something lay beyond. Cranes told of unseen lakes and rivers, while the marsh-pecking redknots told of the distant coasts of lakes and ocean. Every fall, people would have watched the birds fly south and wondered where they were going. The first people were aware of the signs and signals of the natural world, Their artifacts were projectiles, blades, and ivory sewing needles, either used on animal products or made from them or used to procure them. The world around them was a cycle of animals of all sizes, from voles to falcons to some of the largest mammals seen in human evolution. Instead of burning wood for fires, people used megafauna bones, a more abundant resource then. Fire pits as big around as you can reach with your arms, found in central Alaska from 14,000 years ago, contain the ash of primarily burned bones, the ground saturated with charred grease. Archaeologist Charles Holmes, who excavated some of these fire pits, tested the technique himself with moose bones. He told me he'd gone through a lot of kindling, but once he got it going, he could keep a megafauna bone fire burning at a steady 400 degrees Fahrenheit, as good, if not better, than wood. We, too, were following animals, at least one. Our first day hauling gear out of the valley floor, Gilman found grizzly tracks halfway up our route to the Harding. The bear was inexplicably heading onto the ice field, same direction as we were. The tracks were deep, claws raking through every step, species clear by the length of the claws, Ursus, Arctos, Horribilis. Gilman, a science writer and biologist by schooling, looked at them scientifically, seeing a context of migrations. Bears are not so different from us. Similar diets and habitats, omnivores, explorers. With recent historic glacial retreats, coastal grizzlies in Alaska that have been genetically isolated from each other are coming together. Mountain passes not used for many generations are opening as the ice melts. Glaciers step back and genes mix, forming a grizzly DNA renaissance. The grizzly we were incidentally following must have come fresh out of hibernation, pursuing a scent on the wind. Or maybe it was like the song, and the bear went over the mountain just to see what it could see. It was 2 days ahead of us, at least. We hadn't expected to find bears, or anything else alive out here. We were unarmed, no one willing to take the extra weight. Ukuleles are much lighter than firearms. With our power gels and granola, we were a walking candy store. If it came down to a bear confrontation, I'd turn to Gilman, three-time winner of a women's log-splitting competition in a Colorado mountain town, the right person to have by our sides in the wilderness like this. We had ice axes, so Gilman was the obvious choice. She pulled off a glove and reached down, holding her hand over one of the tracks. Her outspread fingers barely filled the space, each track unfolding into a big, white flower. If she had approached an ice field via Alaska 20,000 years ago and discovered a line of bear tracks twice the size of our grizzly, those of Arctotis, she may have had the same reaction. Pause, think about the animal, worry a little, keep going. She would have been loaded down with hides, her bundle containing stone preforms, a ready spear point, a small stone blade for repairs, a bigger one for cutting meat and hide. She would not have come out here to gather summer wool from willows. She would have left her village on some kind of mission, and that would have required the right kind of gear. None of it would have survived. Organic perishables seldom last this long. Nothing would have remained of her clothing, or the wooden shafts of her handles, or her kit. Her fireboard and drill would be long gone. Bronze Age Ötzi, the mummified 5,300-year-old man found on the glacial border of Italy and Austria, carried a flint scraper, an awl, and a small collection of dried mushrooms, a species useful for both starting fires and healing wounds, and his body was found with boot-like leggings made of goat skin, a bearskin cap, a cape and coat made of woven grass, and shoes like moccasins made from deer and bear leather. He had packed his shoes with moss and grasses to keep his feet warm and padded. A person from the Ice Age would have had more animal products than Ötzi. Ötzi lived in the Holocene, and the Pleistocene was a different time on Earth. Humans were few, animals many and oversized. In Ötzi's time, there were predators around, but just the ones we know today, no cave bears or saber-toothed cats. Ötzi would not have worried about stumbling onto Arctotis tracks on the way to an ice field, but his more distant human ancestor, one from the Ice Age, would have scanned the horizon with a fierce sense of alertness, perhaps bringing a pinch of snow up to smell. How fresh, male or female. Besides a small swallow of fear, this person might have felt hopeful. Unless it was heading out to die, a bear marching onto an ice sheet might have known where it was going, might be leaving a path to follow. Our camp was set near the edge of the Harding, 3,000 feet above the valley, where we'd returned for more supplies. 3 days in, we were set to climb onto the ice and start a chain of camps, but we were sluggish from the last few days of snowy mountain travel, the elders popping ibuprofen. Clouds would engulf us, then let go, whiteouts followed by blue sky. Waiting for a signal, a reliable clearing in the weather, we rested around a sitting trench we dug for a kitchen in the snow. I thought the same scene must have unfolded in the late Pleistocene, an ice party looking for a route, rumors of other lands, birds flying in from who knew where as the people lounged on a half-cloudy day, waiting for a reason to go on. I plucked a chord on the ukulele, positioning my fingers as the woman at the trailhead had taught us, twanging out of tune. It wasn't music, but it was close. I stopped playing and looked up. The other four were looking up, too. At the crest of a rise behind us, where our tracks came around the edge of a fresh snowslide, two figures were looking down at us in our basin. They were dressed in wind jackets, shorts, and what at first glance appeared to be tennis shoes. They carried only small waste packs and water bottles, a man, a woman, young Germans, I thought. They must have started hiking early this morning at the trailhead, and when the trail disappeared under snow, they followed our tracks, post-holing a few thousand feet up to our camp, which seemed ludicrous without a heroic amount of gear. For a moment, the world wasn't right. We must have looked like colorful astronauts in moon boots. Our tents were staked into the snow with ice axes. We'd been thinking ourselves as in the middle of nowhere, more adventurous than Ötzi, National Geographic material at the very least, and these two visitors blew it. They continued toward us, bunny hopping from one post hole to the next to reach our camp, as they had to do if they stayed on our tracks. Stepping out, they would have sunk to their knees, and they'd never get out of here. The pair paused when they came close and glanced at us with embarrassment. Embarrassed for themselves or us, I couldn't tell. A polite wave, hi, nice day, have fun, a couple of questions about their need for gear and watching out for changes in the weather, and they were off, exploring farther along our tracks, where we'd been scouting to the ice field. I was wrong about them being German. They were American. But they were indeed wearing tennis shoes. They were unarmed, unspectacular. Their presence didn't make sense to any of us, so we started packing right away. The causes of migration are many. Something pushes you, something else pulls. This couple was our push. We were not as far out as we wanted to believe. In the vastness of Beringia, it may not have taken much of a crowd to send some people fleeing. We broke camp swiftly, packs loaded and ready to go. When the couple came back, we were hoisting full loads onto our backs, grunting and tightening straps on each other's packs. They wished us a good trip, and we wished them the same, wandering apart, not sure we should ever have met. Plates were pushed back at a cafe table in Anchorage, napkins wadded. 5 Alaskan archaeologists sat around talking about what they would do if they had a time machine. Everyone gave a different date in the Ice Age, but picked the same area, the Tanana River of eastern Beringia, within sight of the ice sheet that once broke over the edge of the Alaska Range. Charles Holmes, who was from the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, had discovered and excavated a handful of Ice Age habitations and mammoth butchering sites along the Tanana. He'd been working on a knoll called Swan Point, a 14,500-year-old hunting camp where tools were fashioned, weapons sharpened and repaired, readied for the hunt. Trim, gray-bearded, Holmes said, people would come together to do roundups. It would happen once or twice a year. We've got a 15-year-old female mammoth, a 5-year-old juvenile, and a baby all together. I can envision this little group of mammoths getting whacked, not necessarily right on the site but nearby, and then processed. Holmes said, what we have are the first human footsteps in Alaska. Swan Point has been considered the oldest bona fide archaeological site in the state, not just a butchered Pleistocene bone, but a real settlement. Someone at the table called him out, saying Swan Point couldn't be the actual first settlement, and Holmes corrected himself. Clearly, if they're in the middle of the state, they aren't the first. Holmes used first the way most would, thousands of years reduced to one word. Sitting across from Holmes was Diane Hansen from the University of Alaska in Anchorage. She said, it was a window of opportunity 14,000 years ago, a hunter's paradise. Before that, you would have headed south or to the coast, but you wouldn't have stayed here. Hansen was referring to the last glacial maximum. A glacial maximum is the coldest it gets. Most are about 10 degrees Fahrenheit colder than the north as we know it today. enough to push ice caps to their greatest extent. Places like southern Wisconsin turned into moraines of rock rubble, indicating that this is as big as the ice grew. The height of the last glacial maximum was about 20,000 years ago, around the time people were showing up, based on some of the early dates from Bluefish Caves. A massive ice sheet was sending out frigid winds, freeze-burning the land around it. The land bridge might have been a survivable place at the time, while the Alaskan interior would have been a suffering and hungry country, not like the heyday of Swan Point 14,500 years ago, but like the barren edge of an expanding ice sheet. Layers of coarse, wind-blown sediment have been found throughout the Alaskan interior during this maximum, indicating a lot of blowing grit, while sites across Siberia were being abandoned, the people heading south. They had to find refuge, perhaps following the Porcupine River to Old Crow Basin, nestling into a megafauna sanctuary around Bluefish Caves. Wherever they went, whoever they were, there were few of them, knocked down by generations of long, deep cold, not leaving much, if anything, for archaeologists to find. "Where are they, then?" asked David Yesner, an imposing figure at the table. "Why aren't we seeing them?" Yesner asked this before the 2017 revelation of a 24,000-year-old Beringian horse jaw with butchering marks from Bluefish Caves, a single find that is still not enough to convince many archaeologists. Yesner, with Brillo pad hair and rings on his fingers, is an icon in Alaskan paleosciences. It's hard to disagree with him. Another archaeologist at the table said, "It might be a problem of demographics." Leaning back in his chair like a doubtful king, Yesner said, "It's because they weren't here." The last glacial maximum is a hard time to find anyone in the far north, especially on the American side. Hansen works the Aleutian Islands, an arc of old and some new volcanoes reaching 600 miles from Alaska, almost to Kamchatka. Between sea level changes, glacial rebound, and tectonic uplift and subsidence, it's hard to figure out where things were, she had told me. Some places are up in the air just in a few thousand years. The boat taking Hansen and her crew to their excavation sites and surveys costs $10,000 a day and sits offshore waiting while they work. "There are four archaeologists working on a 1,000-mile-long island chain," she said. "You can see why we can't find anything." It's not true that she hasn't found anything. Hansen has been mapping 3,000-year-old villages and camps, but so far, nothing as old as the Ice Age. Information that far back is spotty, the record shot through with more holes than data. The poor quality of what is known has scientists pounding podiums, some threatening libel suits over contradictory papers. How, when, and where the first people entered the Americas remains one of the world's most contentious prehistoric problems. The climb onto the Harding took us up a steep, blank canvas. No tracks lay ahead. The last storm had abolished all human presence. It was like being born, or maybe like dying. I'd all but forgotten the visitors in tennis shoes. I tried to forget everything, the cities, the deadlines, all of it. A new storm was moving in, summits disappearing around us as a light snow began. I sensed when we passed from snow on mountain to snow on ice. Gilman was marching ahead of me, her pack loaded with skis, ropes, a sled, and an ice axe. She had started to sing. Something must have shifted beneath us. I couldn't hear the words, just her voice as she kicked in steps, snow to her shins. She told me later that it was her fear of crevasses. She'd felt them getting closer, like circling sharks, and so she sang to ease the hike, remembering all those she loved in case one of her steps crashed through and she disappeared into a blue hole below. When she started singing, I figured we must have come onto the Harding, her lullaby carrying us into the storm. By morning, our world was gone. The ice field in our camp had been swallowed by an unbroken whiteout. We should have been able to see a corridor of nunataks sticking up through the ice. Instead, visibility had been reduced to near zero. It wasn't eyelash freezing cold. The wind was gentle, snow steady, but not enough to bury us anytime soon. The sky had simply come down and smothered us. Snow slid off tents as we opened zippers, heads peeked out. The sun was up, but who could say where? We appeared to be floating in a blue-gray emptiness, as mountaineers describe it, the inside of a ping-pong ball. Our window had closed. The first man out was Stevenson, stomping into his boots and squinting through the snow globe around camp, seeing nothing. His partner in the tent, John McInerney, had been climbing with him since they were in high school. McInerney said, "Condition report." "Conditions could be much worse," said Stevenson. Much worse, like raining molten lava? The air tasted like ice. I couldn't get anything more out of it. This wasn't traveling weather, that much we agreed on. Heading out blind across unknown snow bridges and the blocky upheavals around the bigger crevasses was ill-advised when we couldn't see a thing. For that first day of the whiteout, we were either out in the nothingness or cooped up in tents. We all had to do something. Gilman buried herself in Dostoevsky. Q, our photographer-filmmaker, checked batteries, cleaned lenses, cleared memory cards. We three had one tent. Stevenson and McInerney were in the other, the two close friends whiling the hours reading thin paperbacks as old-school mountaineers are wont to do. I mostly stood at the edge of camp and stared at blowing nothing, waiting for anything to emerge. To my back were the vanishing crisscross of our boot prints and the bright blossom of tents. We may think of our far-ranging ancestors as stoic and unquestioning, their senses raised majestically to the wind, but I can imagine one of their band stopping about now and asking, "Where the hell are we going?" When I turned back to camp, Gilman was sitting in the entry to our tent. She was a willow-limbed woman, youngest in the group, early 30s, tall, with short dark hair dyed flame red at the tips. She wore a cone-shaped woolen Soviet hat, red star emblazoned on the front, that made her look like a Russian jester. The rainfly was unzipped, and she sat half in, half out, sketch pad balanced on her knee. Trained as an artist and schooled as a naturalist, she has a sharp eye for landscapes. She said she'd made a drawing of me, and asked if I wanted to see it. I wasn't sure. I was feeling out of place in my ice costume. She turned the sketch pad toward me. It looked like a joke at first, a blank page. Then I saw a lone figure in a lower corner. I was as small as a grain of rice. With pen and ink, she'd captured the way I stand, with my weight on one leg, hood pulled up in the wind. The rest of the page devoured me. She said, "This is what we look like out here." Beringians. I saw them in skins and furs, hunkering down as storms howled over them. They closed their eyes and waited, snow building up. Hunting parties gone astray, or explorers testing the boundaries of the world, you'd expect many to have perished in sudden storms, or been eaten by giant bears on the ice, their spears swatted away like toothpicks. The bones of these lost souls and their last withered skins would have drifted into the ice, been swallowed by crevasses, and turned into a soft powder that rivers would eventually carry to the sea. They'd never be found. For 2 days we drifted inside a place with no up or down, the sun passing invisibly through the sky. Shadows were gone from our faces. Q and I were antsy, too much time cramped in a tent that smelled of fouled synthetic clothing. We came up with a scouting mission. We'd go out as a pair, a short distance, half an hour. With the lay of the terrain, Q felt safe. The surface didn't have the right bend for crevasses. We'd done rock and ice in South America together, and I trusted him. We decided to head out with a GPS, marking camp, going out as far as felt comfortable and then coming back. On the sled we had extra gear and rope in case the day went sour. As we snapped into skis, one of the elders pulled a zipper open and stuck his head out of a tent. "If your GPS fails, don't try finding your way back," he said. "Wait it out." "Got it," I said. Q punched a waypoint into the device and said, "We'll be careful." You see an old friend smile like this and think, some Paleolithic explorer probably beamed with the same expression. Let's see how far we can go. The popular version of the first American colonization is people on their way here, like immigrants on their way to Ellis Island, bustling to see ahead. But people weren't on their way to North America, because nobody even knew North America existed, and so their arrival was an exploration every foot of the way. There might have been adventurers, crazies at the edge of all human societies, willing to do nearly anything, wild-eyed characters heading always for the hills. But most people would have spent their time surviving in hungry country, weathering the unstable ups and downs of worldwide glaciation, in the company of several tons of animals per square kilometer. Life was hard enough and short enough already. Why go off on a lark across the ice when there was already so much to do where you were? The drive may be innate. Some fruit flies, when they're young, are adventurers. When they first chew out of their pinhead eggs as larvae, some wriggle farther than the others. Scientists have studied these individuals and identified a genetic locus connected to foraging. what is known as a rover allele. When the presence of rover alleles is increased, a larva will pass up food and creep toward the limits of its petri dish. Such larvae tend to be found dead around the edges of the dish, their journey more important than living. For a human, this might be identified as a calling, an urgent voice, or insanity. The increased genetic presence of the dopamine receptor known as D4 is correlated